I'm going to work from down here on the floor. Being in the outlook business, I learned you have to move around quite a bit. It's less likely you can hit me with something. I was given this task, and I'm one of these yes men. Somebody calls and says, would you do this meeting? I say, yep, no problem. Give me a topic, fine. I have the luxury to talk about kind of whatever I want, but it has to somehow resemble the topic they gave me. The previous speakers come online recently, like last week maybe, so I didn't really get a chance to study a lot of what they had to say, but what I prepared, and some of it is in the proceedings, ties in very closely with what these two gentlemen talked about, a little bit about what Barry talked about, and some of the other things that are out there. The topic was the cost of meeting consumer demand, and John just talked about consumer demand, and I'm going to recap that. Barry talked about it some yesterday as well. But I'm also going to talk about meeting consumer demands on our product. And that's a little bit of what Kevin spoke of. They're both important. So let's, Renee, let's go ahead and get started. So increased demand. Let's first talk about increased demand for beef. And John Houston just spoke about this. It's a wonderful story. It's grown steadily since 1998. Consumers are willing to pay more for the same product. That's a definition of an increase in demand, a shift in the demand curve. Those of you who went through Econ 101, you remember the old skull and crossbones graph there with the supply and demand curve? And we shift that demand curve out after the 20 years of it declining. And it's the rising tide that lifts all boats. Everyone who produced beef, cattle, benefited from consumers willing to pay more for the same amount of product. Or at the same price, they wanted more product, as John said. Quality, convenience were drivers of that. We've seen, I'll talk a little bit later about the increased premium on choice over select. That's how in the beef industry, when you talk about quality, we immediately jump to the quality grade. Convenience, Kevin talked about that. The heat and serve product for convenience. Wendy's tagline on the ads here in the Midwest is what? Open late. Not, we've got better burgers than anyone else, not taste great, not low carb, it's that we're open until midnight in most places. Convenience. And then finally, the low carb diets, the Atkins, the South Beach, and all those other things. The last 2 or 3 years, particularly the last 12 months, have been a real driver, I think, in some of the demand shifts that we've seen. Next slide. But let's also talk about the increased demands on beef. Consumers have higher expectations on our product. Our partners in the supply chain, like Wendy's and the retailers, have higher demands on us and higher expectations about the product. And that's important as well. The cattle industry, maybe more so than anywhere else in agriculture, has always been a trust-me industry. We buy cattle sight unseen, have them shipped halfway across the country. My word is my bond, my handshake's as good as gold. Trust me. But we're dealing in a prove-it world. And we're starting to see that change come into our industry as well. In the sale block, they say, yep, they've had all their shots, and somebody said they haven't had any implants. That makes them more valuable. Buyers are saying, why? Send me the papers ahead of time. I want to know who signed them. Prove it. Okay. So let's talk about this shift from commodity to product. And a little of this is redundant with what John talked about, but I want to put a little different spin on things. In the commodity world, all beef is beef. We've heard this discussion recently as it relates to BSE and our trading partners with Japan. I've had people within the industry say, you know, science says the infectious agents has never been found other than in those specified risk materials. So all the muscle cuts are the same. Why should we have to do any age verification? Cow beef is the same as every other beef. Beef is beef. And that's the world we've been in. One product, beef. Okay? There was a minimum standard to qualify. In commodities, we set minimums or maximums. What's the maximum amount of foreign material you can have in grain and still call it number 2 yellow corn? What's the minimum amount of marbling you can have and still call it choice? And the way you win in a commodity world is to be the lowest cost producer of the absolute minimum. Who is the lowest cost producer of the absolute minimum? Now, the minimum standard is raising. The most recent one is age verification, the 30-month rule. That's becoming a new standard. The minimum you have to qualify to sell into to make grade. The feed signature ban we've had since 97. Country of origin labeling. Is that going to become a new minimum? To be able to sell as a product of the U.S., you have to be able to verify where it was born and raised. Grades do not define products, they simply define new minimums. This is, here's the minimum to make select, here's the minimum to make choice, here's the minimum to make CAD. Those are new, not new products, but new commodities. In a product world, and John talked about what the processors are doing with branded products and further processing and putting labels on them, but the point is some beef is different from other beef. We're not talking one product, we're talking multiple products. Differentiated by attributes or brands, and consumers are willing to pay more for particular attributes, and we'll talk about that. Different processes, how it was raised, what it received, or what it didn't receive during the production process, or different brands built on reputation and other attributes. For example, if you go to the USDA website, they list 42 different certified beef programs as of Monday morning when I put this slide together. 25 of those programs are Angus. Out of the 42, 25 are Angus, and those are basically phenotypic standards, right? Black hide, upper two-thirds of choice. There's some grading standard that's visual inspection that is determined at the time the animal hits the plant and is processed. There's three Hereford programs that require, that make some breed claim. And then there are four process verified programs that require something more than simply visual inspection. The Red Angus Association's feeder cattle program, the PM Beef, and their plants over here about 60 miles east of here at Windham, Minnesota, and then there's two Nolan Ryan products that are process verified. So let's talk about differentiating our products. Instead of just one, how do we get more than one? How do we fill up that shelf like John showed us in the picture? Well, we have detectable attributes, things consumers can detect, like marbling, at least the grader can make that differentiation. Maybe it's a tenderness, maybe it's flavor. Grass finish, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say maybe I can detect the difference between grass fed and grain fed. There is some difference there, but those are things I can detect. One of the growing areas of product differentiation is what is called credence attributes. Credence attribute is something that even after consumption, you cannot detect the difference. Now think about that. This is a totally different product. It's worth more, but you'll never know the difference. You ready to get your wallet out on that one, guys? But as things like nutrient value or fatty acids, say low omega-3 fatty acids, low linoleic soybeans, things that are different from a nutrient content, BST in milk, you can't detect it. Okay? And there's also process. Was it natural? Free range. Non-fed GMO. So those are different things. Now, detectable. What are some detectable attributes? The most common one we talk about is just simply USDA quality grade. And there appears to be an increasing demand for higher grading beef. This is a choice select box beef spread. This goes back to 1989. This is the annual average. It goes all the way to 2003. If you notice, they were up to about 94 or so. We were averaging around $4 spread. And then we got into the late 90s, that bumped up closer to about an $8 spread. And then last year, we had over a $12 spread on average. This year, we're running ahead of last year. So the spread appears to be widening. Now, just as an aside, last fall, when we saw that spike up there that one week to about $34 spread, and what we've seen, we had a shortage of cattle, particularly the Canadian border closed. The slaughter was down about 12% in the fall. There was a real shortage of choice beef. It was a product. You know, the retailers had been guaranteed so much choice product, they couldn't send select in its place. Yet short-fed cattle, lighter carcasses or so on, the supply wasn't there. And so that price really escalated. Now, this market turns around somewhat. If we get back into a heavier situation, we feed cattle longer, we increase that, we probably won't see a spread quite as wide. But we are seeing more choice. Now, the other thing we've heard in this industry is the talk about going after those carcass premiums, going after the choice, going after prime premiums. We've seen prime premiums $15, $16, $20 a hundredweight for prime. The CAB premiums have increased. And Stroh said, I work quite a bit in the pork industry, and I was starting to have this deja vu all over again because I saw a cattle producer starting saying, man, I'm going to go after those premiums. The pork guys, a decade earlier, were saying, I'm going to get those premiums no matter what it costs me. Well, think about it. I can go after a $6 premium and it only costs me $10 to get there. Right? Got the best coffee shop story in the country. Now, so what is the cost of going after this higher quality grade? Now, we took a very simple approach to this, and sitting here with these population geneticists, I'm not going to get into a statistical debate with you, but economists like to manipulate numbers with the best of them. Right? You take the data set, you just beat it until the truth falls out, and then you go publish it. Now, what we did is we had a data set, and this is over multiple years, retained ownership cattle. We had about 1,100 head in this study. We had careful, very careful carcass data with marbling scores and fat thicknesses. We also used the Cornell model to be able to calculate individual feed efficiencies. But we set up a profit equation and run a regression to say what are the determinants of profit on an individual animal basis, and we included in there grid marketing, a kind of a standard type quality grid rather than a yield grid. What we have up here are standardized beta coefficients. This is another way of looking at the regression, so that those weighting figures you see over there, those standardized coefficients, you can compare to one another. They're in the same terms. We took out, otherwise one would be in pounds and one would be in inches and the other would be in percent fat and the other is in marbling score. You can't compare those. This puts them all on the same unitless measure. And then we looked at four different choice select spreads. So notice the top line there, $4 choice select spread. The biggest number on that line that determines profit is hot carcass weight. The bigger you can get them, the more profitable they work. That's including feed costs, yardage, everything else. But notice as that choice select spread widened out to 8, to 12, to 16, suddenly the marbling score became the biggest determinant of profit. So can we chase after a quality grade? Yeah. We can't ignore the other things, don't get me wrong. Don't ignore feed efficiency and all those, but you also can't ignore grading. You can't ignore grade. Okay, next slide. Now, the other thing we did, and this is a much smaller data set, so take this with a grain of salt. We're doing some additional research on it. I think the industry needs to do other research. That first study was started in the feedlot. What determined profit? On a smaller subset, there's about 250 head in here from five different herds. We had information back down to the cow herd. We had body condition score, frame score on the cow, so we could estimate a cow carrying cost, if you will. What would it cost to carry that cow that produced the calf, that produced the carcass, that produced the profit? And the question is, can we afford to produce those cattle that make a profit in the feedlot? Again, in the industry, we're so segmented, we're what's best in the feedlot, is that best for the cow herd? Again, very preliminary, but what was encouraging, we divided the cow cost from low to high in half. The low-cost cows averaged $148.50 feed cost compared to $168, about $20 a cow difference. The group divided in half. The feedlot return on the low-cost cow was higher than the feedlot return on the high-cost cow. Again, be careful, but the good news was they ran in the same direction. They ran in the same direction. Instead of saying, boy, what the feedlot wants, that's the most profitable thing for the feedlot, being the least profitable thing for the cow herd, they at least were compatible. And we need more work in this area. Maybe a lot of our breeders are already doing it. Now, let's shift over a little bit to consumers. Body of literature in economics is experimental auctions looking at consumers' willingness to pay. And they'll go out and do an experimental auction where consumers taste product and take money out of their wallet and make a choice to pay for something. It's not a survey saying, what do you think you might do? They put money on the table. Jason Lusk, who's a grad student at K-State at the time, this is his dissertation, worked with consumers to see what if they would be willing to pay for a guaranteed tender steak. And in that first study up there, they didn't label them. They just took a steak that had kind of a moderate to tough Werner Brasler shear score, let them eat that, then let them taste one that was Werner Brasler more tender. And then they say, would you pay to upgrade from this first steak to the more tender one? And half the people said, yeah, they'd pay $1.23. The other half didn't care. The first one was acceptable enough to them. Then he did a second study where he told them this was a guaranteed tender steak. Let them taste both of them, but they knew in advance which one was tender and would they pay more. We had 60% willing to pay and a much bigger premium. The point being the labeling, the information was made the product more valuable to the consumer, even though it's the same product. Excellent. Another example of that, Dylan Faze, Wendy Umberger, University of Nebraska at the time, compared grass-fed to grain-fed. This was 4 or 5 years ago, maybe longer. They had some grass-fed Argentine beef, and they were comparing it in Denver and Chicago in these experimental auctions. These were both select-grade, so select-fed grain-fed animals, as well as select grass-fed. And what they did across all of them, on average, consumers would pay $1.61 more for grain-fed beef. So, if you can only have one beef product in the world, we're doing it right. We're feeding them grain. Consumers will pay more for it. But as you look at the data, 23% of those consumers, nearly a fourth, would pay a premium for the grass-fed over the grain-fed. So if you could have two beef products, you can get more money out of the consumer. And what we're talking about, and particularly John talked about, is having dozens of products. And how do we more closely meet that consumer's demand and extract that profit? A key part of this, however, is the integrity, the prove-it part. USDA has been asked more and more to verify these products. You're making a label claim to the consumer. It's natural, it's better tasting, it's grain-fed, it's all these claims. USDA said, well, wait a minute, what does that mean? They had an open comment period that ended around the end of the year saying, let's have some definitions. The example they used, I found it kind of humorous, but it drove home the point. How many of you are familiar with the Nebraska corn-fed beef program? A lot of people in here. Okay, what does that mean? Does that mean Nebraska beef-fed corn? Does it mean beef-fed Nebraska corn? What did it mean? And so USDA is becoming more of a stickler on if you're going to make a label claim, you're going to have to prove it. Particularly, you get into more branded products, more value added. What does it mean and how do you back it up? So there's also this cost of meeting this consumer demand for these niche markets. It may cost more to produce those specialty products. There's also a cost of verifying it and proving it. One example, and Stroh and I had the opportunity to go to Australia, I guess it was November of 2002. Hell of a good trip, 2001. Australia and New Zealand. One of the things that they were doing there, and you guys probably talked about this at DIF before, but the Meat Standards Australia had developed a guaranteed tender product. Keep in mind, in Australia, 80% or so of the product is grass-fed, 20% is grain-fed. And so it's a little more of a crapshoot when you go in and buy a piece of meat in the store about how tender or tough it is. But they developed a mechanism, a label, if you will, to make it a guaranteed tender product. It had to do with the age of the animal, whether it was fed grain or not, how many days, percent Bots Indicus. So those are things the producer could control. Then there were some implant things, so whether it was electrical shock of the carcass, how it graded, the amount of marbling, color of the fat, color of the lean, and how long it was aged. And then at the retailer, they could decide to sell it after 14 days aging. It might have one grade. If they aged it 21 days, it would get a better grade. Again, the science would probably back that up. And in the restaurant, the chef had to be certified. And they would audit restaurants, and if they weren't cooking it properly, they weren't going to carry the label. But again, ways to add value to the product. We went to a small family-run packer who was filling predominantly Brahman, 50%, sometimes 75% Brahman, using these steps to compete with, in this case it was ConAgra, was one of their major competitors. But they could go in with a consistent, predictable product that Kevin talked about, using the science, the verification, the documentation, the procedures to predict a predictable product, and as a small player, actually take some customers away from some of the big ones. Now, retail sector is changing as well. Kevin talked to you about Wendy's. I think they are in the top five, maybe fourth on sales out of the largest restaurant chains. Retail grocers are becoming more powerful and more demanding. It's not just the restaurant chain. There are 10 firms, grocery store, grocery chains have 49% of the U.S. market share. A decade ago, 10 firms might have had 20 or less. Walmart and Sam's Club, they're both the same company, have 17% alone. Now, if you ever want to see a packer humbled, talk to them after they've had an interview with Walmart. They do know how you feel when they come to visit. What's interesting, though, is there's kind of this battle of the brands. Who's going to own the brand? Who's going to reap the brand equity? Now, John talked about Hormel and Tyson and Purdue and all of these others out there, and that's a key part of it. But a lot of these folks, like Kroger's or Walmart and others, some of them want the brand themselves. And they're going to have standards put on that as well. There's also liability issues. Think about somebody like a Tyson. When they were selling anonymous commodity beef that come through their plant and went to a store, say to a Hy-Vee or a Kroger, and it went in the meat counter as anonymous choice grading beef. And if somebody wasn't happy, they're unhappy with beef. Now think about one of those branded products that has the 800 number on there for customer satisfaction. And if there's a problem, and particularly if there's a safety issue, they can just hand that 800 number to their attorney to say, call this when we start the lawsuit. There's significant liability when you start making claims and putting your name and your reputation that rides on every cut of meat going out with your name. And so again, we're going to see tighter expectations or standards as those people put their reputation on our product. But many of them, and again, to get credibility, are looking to outsource this audit, if you will. Traditionally, we've relied on USDA. We still largely rely on USDA, but will we begin to use other folks? Temple Grandin on the animal welfare is a part of that. Temple or her designs or what people are trusting, it's not McDonald's or Wendy's doing their own inspections, per se. Other changes in the retail sector, heavy European influence. Two of the top 11 grocers in the U.S. are European-owned. In the world, four of the 10 world's largest grocers are European, and all four of those are operating in the U.S. So why do we care? In Europe, particularly after BSE in the United Kingdom, we saw a significant meltdown in their food safety concerns and issues and how things are handled. The retailer stepped into what they refer to as the chain captain role, the captain of that supply chain. And the retailer stepped up to the consumer and said, "You can't trust the government anymore, we'll take care of it." And you had the retailer telling the consumers that they were working in their best interest. Now, the U.S., and I think we saw this through the BSE cases in December and what we saw in Canada, here in North America, our consumers still trust our government on the safety issues. And I think that is essential. Other countries, that's not the case. They're looking for something else. Okay, Renee. So, the chain captain model, as we see in Europe, is fairly costly, however. Safety becomes a competitiveness issue, where you'll have one retail chain say, "Our food is safer than our competitors. Not more convenient, not better service, not better tasting, it's just safer because of all of these procedures and protocols we put in place to make it that way." That gets costly. Farmers must be audited to be able to sell. It's a market access issue. And if you're selling to different companies, you have to be audited by both of them. So you may have two or three different auditors, the things you have to follow. And they were auditing for multiple things. The feed ban, obviously, was one as it relates to BSE, but auditing also on animal rights or animal welfare. This is Europe. And worker safety. That's the next slide. This is an example. This was kind of the equivalent, John, of the old livestock and meat board in Britain. This is the farm-assured British beef and lamb. Because the retail chains had their auditors, finally the industry stepped up and said, "We'll have one audit that we will do on farms so they don't have to do multiple ones." And notice, that's that same sign back there in the corner, had the registration number and everything. But notice over here this sign that's up above my head that says, "Caution, fragile roof, you know, must use crawling boards." That was a hay barn with 14-foot high sidewalls. But in order, or part of their audit, they had to post signs like this for worker safety in order to pass the audit. The other thing that farm said, they got wrote up on two things the last time they were audited. One, they didn't record the dates they wormed their dogs. And two, they didn't have the fire exits in the cattle barn clearly marked. I was amazed that their cattle could read. But the point being, we don't want to follow the European model blindly. We want to maintain control of this. Okay, next slide. Animal welfare is one of those issues we want to stay involved in. We want to drive the boat, not be drugged behind it. McDonald's has plant verification. Wendy's, Kevin just talked about Wendy's has plant verification. The Food Marketing Institute and the National Council of Chain Restaurants come out with their animal care guidelines in the last 18 months or so. I know the NCBA is looking at some of these. It's more of an industry-led, industry-wide set of guidelines and standards. If we look at the pork industry, SWAP, Swine Welfare Assurance Program, we have farms being SWAP certified now. We have a couple of people on our staff that are SWAP certified to go out and do farm audits. But we may see the day, like in the pork industry, where they said you cannot sell if you're not PQA certified. You may have the day where you cannot sell if you're not SWAP certified. Okay? And they even have a TQA trucker quality assurance. And we do have some plants that, because of this rough handling issue, we have had truckers pull up, unload, not do things properly, and simply have that trucker banned from ever driving into that plant again. So they are starting to enforce some of these issues. So we see growing demand. There's a widening choice select spread. There's demand for choice. We've got a consolidating retail sector. We've got brands and claims and liability issues. And the idea with liability issues is you just keep pushing them back to the other guy. Consumers are looking for more choices. And even in our commodity market, we're seeing rising standards. So what do we do? Well, it really depends on if you see yourself as a victim or an opportunist. Is this a problem or an opportunity, Kevin? Most, if not all, this is under the manager's control. That's you folks. You determine your own destiny. Some of these changes are going to require a production response, like genetics, like nutrition, things that this VIF has traditionally dealt with. Some of it simply require a change in the way you do business, and I think others have talked about that. One of the ways to approach this is through quality management systems. This is kind of the business school view of the world, of just a management system, and particularly where we have multiple people, maybe employees, maybe somebody spoke yesterday, Marshall, I think, said they had 5 different farms or ranches here in South Dakota. How do you know everything is going on right in every place? How do you keep track of all of it? How do you keep track of the paperwork? Right? So what these quality management systems are is a producer-directed, meaning you write your own rules, and you will be graded against your own rules, but they have the way to assure the producer is capable of meeting the requirements of a given market, document that the requirements were in fact met, and as Barry talked about, it assures that the producer has the information needed to make decisions in his best interest. And how do you do all that without burying yourself in so much paperwork that you don't get anything else done? It has to be practical. It has to be functional. These quality management systems, there's lots of different models out there. They range in complexity, cost, and flexibility. Some of them require a third-party verification in order for them to be recognized and have value, yet the principles of those are still helpful. Examples include ISO 9000-2000. This is kind of the internationally recognized manufacturing standard. We're beginning to see some of that in agriculture. USDA Process Verified Program. And a lot of people have thrown around this process verified term. This would be a noun and not an adjective here. This is a program that USDA will come out and do the audits and give you a USDA stamp of approval. The Red Angus program we talked about is one of those. And then ISO 14001 on the environmental side. Quality management systems, there is a cost associated with developing management systems, doing the audit, keeping the records, getting certified. What are the benefits? Well, for one, and we're not there yet, but we may be someday, it helps us assure market flexibility. We don't get locked out of some markets because we don't have the appropriate documentation or information we need. The other thing that the research would show, largely in other industries, but I think it applies to agriculture, is it improves management and it lowers cost. And that's a tough nut for us in agriculture to swallow, because every one of us is always the absolute best manager there is for that set of resources. This is a way to prove to yourself that that is in fact true. Then the other question is who's going to pay me for this? And again, what we've seen in other industries is you pay you for this. Invariably, companies that go down this road save enough money through better management to more than pay for the program. And oftentimes in other companies, other businesses, it is a cost of doing business because you have no customers unless you can prove it. So, finally, I want to end up with just what is the cost of not meeting consumer demands? Well, one, the commodity market will always be there, but the hurdles are rising. We're getting higher expectations, higher standards. We've got to be able to keep up with them just to be in the business. There are missed opportunities in some of these value-added markets if you are not eligible to enter them by having the documentation or having the minimum standards you need to get into those. And then finally, John talked about this, poultry being the enemy. We used to worry a lot about losing out to pork and poultry, and that's at the industry level. Remember, Barry had that graph and said the individual firm faces this flat demand curve at the industry. We're now talking about products or supply chains. Some producers are going to lose out to other beef producers. And that may not be that I can't sell. It's just that somebody else gets more money for their calves or their fed cattle than I do. And we're clearly beginning to see more of that. So things are changing very rapidly. I think this demand shift that John talked about is a big driver of that, and it's clearly a great opportunity when we're facing increasing demand and trying to find ways to keep up with it, rather than how we've been scrambling for the last 20 years of trying to stay ahead of falling demand. So, with that...